Typically at noon, we would be talking, we would be listening to PRI's The World. But again, in our effort to bring you as much local programming as we possibly can over the 2 days of our spring membership drive, stay in local. And for this hour, going to be talking about local food and all the various efforts in that area and how that has grown. Again, pardon the pun, I can't get away from that one. But how that this is growing on the Kenai Peninsula and some of the opportunities. And to help us along and talk about some of these things, we have with us live in studio Amy Seitz.
Hello.
And Brian Olson.
Hello.
And good to have you both with us. Amy Seitz, of course, from Lancashire Farms and with the Alaska Farm Bureau, and Brian Olson with Alaska Berries in Soldotna. And once again, thank you so much for taking some time and being with us today. And I guess just to kind of start off, and either one of you can take hold of this question, I'm curious, you know, to just get kind of an overview of, you know, how things in the local food scene, I mean, we know that things are, there are a lot more opportunities and a lot more people involved, but if I could get you guys to sort of, from your perch, from your operations that you were both involved with, talk a little bit about how you've seen things develop and change over the last couple of years and what direction things are going.
Yeah, thanks, Shaylin.
Yeah, you bet.
So over the years, you know, we've seen lots of different opportunities coming up for our local farmers on how to get their food to the market. I know the last year and a half or so, there's been a real effort to get more local foods in the restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And Heidi Che with Soil and Water and Megan with Odie's have really kind of led that charge to have.
Yeah, Megan Schaffsma and hosting lots of events there to do those things.
And connecting farmers and restaurant owners.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a really exciting aspect of getting more food out to the consumers and all the different options, the growth of farmers markets, the online food hub. It's really exciting to see all the different options out there.
Yeah. And Brian, remind me, how long has Alaska Berries been around?
Well, we got licensed about 12 years ago with our business, and it just kind of evolved since then.
Yeah.
And Amy covered that very well with all the folks that are being heavily involved in this. What I have also seen, too, is a lot of folks who have never gardened or grew anything. That's grown exponentially in the last 5 or 6 years around the peninsula, as far as I've seen it firsthand, where they come out to the farm and they're never have planted anything before, but they want to grow their own food. And that's, I've seen a huge increase in that. And I think other businesses have too.
And just in general, just the interest in being able to do those things. And we get back to that sort of subsistence kind of a lifestyle that so many folks around here came here for and live here for and are proud to be a part of. And to see more interest in that has got to be encouraging for you folks. Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of interest at, you know, anywhere from the kids to adults. And where my farm is, we're right on the bike path, the Unity Trail. Mm-hmm. And if I'm out there, a lot of times people will stop me and just, oh, I didn't realize we had sheep on the peninsula.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we have a livestock guardian dog and a lot of interest in just how that relationship between the guardian dog and the sheep.
Uh-huh. And we have some new sheep just this morning, right? How many?
Yeah. Pair of twins born. First one came out about midnight. Two boys.
Farming at all hours. The clock never stops,
yep,
right?
Yep, I was out there outside with my headlamp on delivering, thinking, well, I better have a lot of coffee before noon.
Coffee is what makes farming go around, for sure. Well, talking about folks having more interest in this, and Brian, you mentioned people wanting to come out to the farm and actually see things. You know, one of the things that I wanted to talk about, and we covered it here on KDLL in the news a little bit last week. There was a woman from Palmer who was talking about this new idea of agritourism, and she's been quite successful with it up in Palmer. And for I was really excited to have both of you in because you're two very well-established businesses and farms in the area. What are your thoughts on agritourism? Is that, I know that Alaska Berries does tours, and how welcoming is the, maybe welcoming is not quite the right word, I guess, how ready are local food operations, farming operations on the Kenai Peninsula for that sort of opportunity? Is that something that you guys see as being a potential for growth and being a way to really get things out there and get folks exposed to what's going on?
Yes, I believe so. My partner is my wife, Lori Olson, and she attended the workshop. I think it was at Odie's, and there was another place that they held it too.
They had a meeting at the Kenai River Center, and then there was so much to talk about. They got together the next morning at Everything Bagels, because there's so much to talk about.
Yes, and I really didn't even know about farm tour agribusiness until Amy collaborated with us this year on a group farm tour that's going to come around.
Oh, and really?
And then after attending the with my wife attending the workshops on what you just mentioned, it's. The research that's behind it now is the millennials and baby boomers both are really interested in agritourism. They want to go to where the local people are eating and where the local people are getting their food sources from. So it's a little bit, I think it'll add a little bit, to the, well, it will. It just will.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, a lot of, we've mostly had schools come by to kind of educate the students, but then also participated in some of the local food week tours and just the interest from members of the public. Either they had contact with farms growing up, or their parents or cousins farm down in the States, or they've never been on a farm and just want to see
and smell and
and touch.
Uh-huh.
But I think that's the touching part is one. Especially with livestock,
that can be a little more dicey.
Yeah, and so I think there's obviously some work on the part of the farmers to make sure it's as safe as possible, but definitely giving people a good experience.
Yeah, and something that came out for me at that meeting is this idea that it's an opportunity for folks who have their own operations to sort of tell their story face-to-face to folks who are really interested in what they're producing. And I'll just open this up to both of you. And how would you characterize sort of your story when you have folks to the farm? How do you tell that story? And Amy, if you want to go first.
Yeah, so our story, my family's story, we start out, I'm third generation.
And this is Lancashire Farms.
Lancashire Farms. So my grandparents moved up in 48, 49, and I'm still on the same piece of property. And then my aunt with Ridgeway Farms, I grew up spending summers with her and her family on the farm. So it's just a whole long history getting the farm to where it is now.
Generational.
And I think having people think about how the farmers back in those days had to do with, clearing the land when there's not the nice big John Deere tractors or
a lot of things by hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, my grandpa had a sawmill. I think he leased 16 acres in Soldotna to do the sawmill and acres of potatoes. He even had a dairy at one point. So just that teaching people how we've moved through the different generations, and then we went to a hobby farm for a little bit. Now we're growing back up to commercial.
Scaling back up. And the important part of that is having the demand to grow from a hobby farm where you're taking care of just what you need and actually making some money off of it.
Yeah.
Well, and Brian, of course, with Alaska Berries in Soldotna, I know that folks, when they visit your operation, there's a little bit of a story there to be told. And so tours, maybe organized tours coming through a busload at a time would be something new. But having folks to your place to see how things work isn't necessarily new for you.
No, not necessarily. The Garden Club has been a great cooperator, I'll put it that way. They've had a lot of tours at our farm, and we enjoy having them folks out there. Because our story is pretty laid back. It's question and answer mainly. They come out and they want to know. They want to know, how did you do this, or what are you using this for, or what would you recommend? And we don't sell anything that we don't grow. Mm-hmm. And that was something that got us started into growing our own plants and finding out which plants did well here in our environment, under what conditions, and then just start narrowing it down. So we've been through hundreds of different varieties of berry plants that don't do well here and found some that we do like. And now we're pretty much established. Everything in the farm is pretty much developed to the point where we can't really plant much more. And the value adding has been the blessing for us. We started out just selling the plants and the fruit, and that was great. But it takes a lot of labor to run a small farm. And to be able to hire folks to do the help and on the farm, you know, we had a value add for our sake to be sustainable, and it's worked really well for us.
And that's jams and jellies, wines, of course, yeah.
Yeah, jams, jellies, syrups, vinaigrettes, vinegars, and plants, and we just now are finishing up getting approved through DC for a fruit juice drink, a natural fruit juice drink that doesn't have any artificial ingredients in it. There's only two ingredients, and they're both juices, period. And that's always been our goal, is to get something like that out too for folks who want a healthy juice drink. And we think that's going to be a great success. And it's also couples with our Hascap berry, which that's our flagship plant on the farm. And it's just such a healthy berry to begin with.
Yeah.
And we couple that with some apple juice, and it makes some folks that we've been trawling with have seemed to like it, so we're excited about that.
I want to pick on you a little bit more, Brian, because I'm curious. Berries, to me anyway, with my very not green thumbs, seem like, and you mentioned going through some trial and error and figuring out what works. Are berries like a really finicky thing to make go here? Of course, we know that natural berry picking is, I mean, they sort of happen on their own. They're very robust, sort of in their natural state. But when you're going for a sort of uniform and commercial product, are they more finicky? Is it difficult? Talk a little bit about developing the different plants that you grow on the farm.
Well, and this is just my opinion. You know, if you ask 10 berry growers, you'll get 11 different answers. But, you know, it's not just been me. I don't want to sound like it's just been me. Michael Bryan out north has got a wonderful farm out there, and his daughter runs that farm. And
with the orchards
growers
there, yep.
They make a great product, and they grow a lot of great plants. And I've worked with Mike in the past. We've also worked with the Co-op Extension Agency heavily, and the University of Fairbanks, to utilize their technical support on some things. The finickiest plant that I feel in our farm is the blueberry, which
is
blows
that right?
people away, because they say, well, they're all over.
Exactly. That would be my first thought.
Yeah, and they are. But to grow a commercial variety, years ago there was a group that tried to take wild blueberries and form it where you could introduce them to your farm, and it wasn't successful. They haven't figured out what the symbiotic relationship is with that blueberry in the natural environment yet. And somebody eventually will, and then it probably will work. Right now, nobody has come up with that. So we grow a commercial variety, and I killed literally 1,000 blueberry plants the first couple years. Trial and error.
Yeah.
And anyway, we were able to work with the Department of Agriculture, contacted us wanting to do a blueberry trial experiment for 3 years on our farm to see exactly what commercial varieties would grow. And we ended up picking the North Blue after the test was all done, the North Blue variety. It's a half-high blueberry. But you can't just dig a hole and stick it in the ground. It will die. It won't thrive. So that's the finickiest one. And we really try to educate folks who want to buy our blueberry plants that they have to be planted in 4.5 to 5 pH. They just won't thrive. They won't produce very well. And the winters. If they get snowpack and bury the plant, you get a great crop the next
right.
year. If we have 2 or 3 winters ago, we didn't have any snow at all. And the yield drops way down. And blueberry wines, we don't. You know, on a good year, we only have like 6-7 rows. I don't know how many plants we have. Maybe 500 blueberry plants in that one section. And, you know, some years we get a great crop, and the blueberry wine sells really well. So we keep it as a reserve wine just because it's a gamble from year to year.
Are berry wines like a grape wine where they are affected by age and that sort of thing? Or,
well, I hate to sound pretentious, but we say no grapes are harmed in the making of our wines. and the reason I say that is that fruit wines always get compared to grape wines. And I think for us, we don't like to do that. We like to say fruit wines should stand on their own. They're a different breed of cat.
Yeah.
They are meant to be drank young. They're not like some wines where you want to drink them 50, 60 years down the road when you're 105. we encourage folks that fruit wines traditionally have a bell curve on the out where they're going to peak out far as that goes.
They're not a collector's item.
No, in fact, we have 4-acre farm, and it's high-density planted. And so the amount of crop that we get determines what our yield's going to be on the back end as far as wines, jams, syrups, and so forth. So there's years that we have a lean crop. We don't have a lot of product in that regards. So there is some risk involved with that aspect of it, but We tell folks, you know, when you buy a bottle of wine from us, it's not something to be a heirloom sitting up on the shelf for a year or two. It's meant to be drank young. By the time we've bottled it, it goes through what we call bottle shock for a short period of time, and then it marries back up with its flavors, and get her drank.
Yeah, enjoy it. Enjoy it quick.
Yes.
Enjoy it quick. Brian Olson and Amy Seitz joining us during day one of the KDLL spring membership drive, trying to keep my season straight here. 283-8433 is the number if you would like to call and show your support for your local public radio station, or you can go online anytime at kdll.org. And partnerships seem to be in a place where there aren't big farms. There's no monoculture like we tend to think about in big places like where I'm from in Iowa. Partnerships must be all the more important. And whether that's partnerships between local businesses or partnerships between, you've mentioned the Soil and Water Conservation District or the University Extension Office, how have those changed over time? Are those getting stronger? Are those more sort of robust and more people willing to kind of stick their neck out a little bit and make those partnerships? And maybe you can speak to that with your Farm Bureau hat, Amy.
Yeah, and I'm sure there were partnerships before, but I do think there is more of a collaborative attitude among farmers and farming organizations. A lot of work with Soil and Water and Cooperative Extension and Farm Bureau and Division of Ag.
The list kind of goes on,
And Food Policy Council. I mean, there's a lot of ag organizations that are trying to work together instead of everyone doing the same thing, to kind of join together. But then also among farmers, the online food hub is kind of a way to not have a co-op, but also make it so small and medium farmers can offer their items for sale, but the buyers who want larger quantity can go in and buy from multiple farmers to get the quantity they want. So mm-hmm. It's kind of a co-op that's not really a co-op.
It's loosely based on that model and works well here.
Yeah. But there are also other, co-ops being formed for the purpose of the small and medium farmers to put their products together to reach those larger markets. Mm-hmm. So, and I think as we expand our products, I think that's going to be good to get those small and medium farmers.
Yeah. And something I'm curious, again, for both of you, having grown these businesses, Amy, you mentioned going from, the family farm being kind of a hobby thing and then finding a market for more products and sort of a reason and an excuse to grow the business side of it a little bit. And Brian, for you, the same thing. For both of you, maybe you could talk a little bit about what it was like to grow that business and figure out, were there major stumbling blocks in how to market yourself? Brian's wearing an Alaska Berries hat, so we know there's some marketing involved, but what were some of the big lessons that you kind of learned along the way in how to make a successful go at it? And
I think we're still learning.
Mm-hmm. Never stop learning. Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's the same for Brian, but that, okay, if I buy 6 more ewes to add to the herd, am I?
there's a lot to calculate, and it's a little bit of a gamble.
Yeah, especially here in Alaska, shipping livestock up is not easy or convenient or cheap. So from that aspect, you are taking a chance, but you also kind of have an idea, and try to incorporate as many different products like Alaska Berries with their jams and wine mm-hmm. and juices, and then we obviously offer meat, but then also wool products, and just trying to find, we have the really nice wool for spinners and making hats and stuff, and then finding ways to use the lesser quality wools in dryer balls and felted soap bars. So just trying to use as much of the products as we can.
Yeah, nose to tail, that kind of thing.
That's right.
Yeah. Brian?
And Amy's a third generational farmer, and it's the head start, I'll put it that way, whereas I think the biggest stumbling block for folks who are looking into getting into growing, farming here in our area is patience, because we have a tendency, like our land was all boreal forest right up to the first building. It was only one building on the property, and it took years to clear it and develop it by ourselves. And we used a sawmill, bought a sawmill, sawed all the logs and the boards, made buildings out of it, sold firewood. the topsoil around here is pretty lean, so all the stumps, you had to pick them up, shake them with an excavator, let them set. So you got every little grain in good soil.
It's so young, the topsoil. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it's lacking in nutrients. You just, it's hard to find a place you can just dig a hole and plant something. So the patience part of it for us is, and we at that time we worked with Tom Johns, who was the co-op extension agent, and I made the mistake of taking a master gardening class from him and an organic gardening class from him, and I got addicted to growing things. And he recommended we grew cover crops for the first 3 years, get some critters in there, geese, chickens, ducks, pigs, whatever you can to help break up the soil. And you know, when you're looking at your life go by and you're saying, geez, a lot of folks don't want to take the time to do it. And then I always say the second thing is to plant a fence before you plant anything if it's a berry crop. Because if you can't keep the moose and the other critters off of it, you're just struggling. And that's hard to do. And it's expensive because we don't manufacture fencing material up here. It has to be shipped up. You got the expenses. And I think the other stumbling block would be the cost for buying certain Alaska-grown products is... we can't compete with the mass strawberries produced out of California when they sell them two pounds for $5.
Right.
We can't grow them for that price and stay sustainable. And I think a lot of folks around here realize that, and they're willing to pay a little bit more for a ripe, juicy, red all the way through strawberry.
It's hard to beat something fresh off the vine.
But yet, on the other hand, too, you know, economics have a big part to play. You need to budget your own... your food items and everything. But the stumbling blocks, I think, are land, location, developing that property so you can grow something economically and efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the past, people had mentioned labor sources was a problem because of the starting salaries that you have to pay. Alaska doesn't have a state requirement for salary for ag workers. I didn't even know that at the first. We pay our workers above minimum wage because it's hard work and it's outdoors and it's all different kinds of weather. I have to say throughout the years is that the young people that we hire, and I say young people, most of our workers are young folks, and hard workers show up on time. I don't have any complaints about the labor force around here for the folks that come by our farm that want to work, because first of all, they have a desire to be out there if that's something that they think they have an interest in. And we've had kids that were 10 and 12 would come out and say, I want to go to work on your farm. We say, well, we don't hire anybody until you're 16. And they'll come back when they're 16 and they'll go to work.
Yeah.
And that's an asset to our community. There's a lot of young folks around here that have good work ethic.
And Amy, that's a good question for you too, in terms of staffing the farm. Is it just a family run affair for Lancashire?
At this point, primarily family run affair. But obviously, looking for more. we're getting and that's we're at
there
the
never,
next.
There are never enough hands. Yeah,
we're at the next step where it would be really handy to have a farmhand. You know, someone who can be there, who I can count on to always be there.
And those are sort of growing pains. That's where you get to that point where all of a sudden, that's not. It's something to deal with, and it's a consideration to make, but it's one of those things that it's like kind of a good problem to have when you find yourself at that point where, gee whiz, just me and the missus doing this by ourselves isn't going to work anymore.
Which part of the reason we're at that point is family moved away. So, so we used to have more family on hand, and now it's, you know, we're down to three of us.
Yeah.
And...
But to me, that speaks a lot about the desire for folks who live here and folks who visit too, who are interested in those sorts of things. But for the folks who live here to place enough demand out there that it can be tough to keep up. And that has to be incredibly encouraging for you guys.
Yeah. I, anytime you have a waiting list for your products is good or selling out moving it out the door.
Yeah. Having it spoken for before it's even in the ground.
And something that Amy and you both mentioned too is the collaboration. What I've seen, I was going to answer that question too on regards to the University of Fairbanks, the Co-op Extension Agency. I have seen a major increase in the other organizations like Soil Conservation District, the Food Hub, all the other areas that Amy mentioned previously. I've seen a real positive leap forward with all those groups. On the other hand, I've seen a huge reduction in the funding for Co-op Extension Agency, the University of Fairbanks, and I think that's not helping the state of Alaska very well. I've spoken to quite a few politicians about it, that everybody promotes Alaska grown, and that's great. But you got to put your money where your mouth is. And for us, unfortunately, we've lost so many key people that were so beneficial to our state and ag. We used to have a virus, a plant virus specialist, and that was a huge benefit for us, you know, because you can, you know, it's a huge risk when you're depending on a crop for your livelihood, and that's the risk that every farmer takes. Mm-hmm. That's just granted. But it's also nice to have a professional there so that when you do have something you've never noticed before, you could send it off and to a state organization to help you out.
Yeah.
I'm always going to be a vocal person about funding for ag. I'm never going to stop because it irritates me if I have to go out of state to get advice when we have so many wonderful farmers in this state and folks that support ag and they actually do try to promote it and do those things. So I encourage everybody to always get a hold of their elected officials and promote funding these things because this is probably the most challenging environment to grow things, in my opinion. And maybe that's selfish to say, but I have lived in other states, and I've seen, like you said, in Iowa, that's my father's 93, and he lives on his farm by himself in South Dakota. He's not actively farming, but his yard's bigger than my farm, and he mows it 5 days a week. And, you know, he can go back there and throw a tomato seed in anywhere on that ground.
Just kick the dirt over.
Just kick it.
Toss it. And yeah.
It's
as long as there's enough rain, you're good to go.
Black, good, rich soil, mm-hmm. I don't know how many feet deep. He's taken very good care of it. Well, up here, it's a whole different ballgame. Mm-hmm. So it's a challenging environment. So I think that, you know, we need to have funding to continue to evolve, especially with our climate. I didn't want to get off in a different topic, but, you know, the climate, when I first started, there were so many frost-free days a year. And, boy, we never planted anything till June 7th, June 10th because of risk of killing frost. Mm-hmm. And, boy, the last... 10 years or so. It's just I look at my logbook because I keep a daily log for weather and events and mm-hmm. good days, bad days, whatever. And I'm speaking for myself, but just on our little farm there, I've noticed we're getting insects and bugs that we never had before, that I've never seen before. So there's a shift evolving now. We're planting earlier. We have a longer fall season. So we're getting, you know, we're able to experiment too. There's some positive aspects. We always trial 4 to 5 new raspberry varieties every year, outside and inside, to see how they do because raspberries are a huge crop up here.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of folks like raspberries.
Oh yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a challenging environment.
No, I'm really glad you brought that up because that was definitely one of the things on my list. Is you've both been in this long enough that we have seen a pretty dramatic shift in the growing seasons. I think has been the biggest one. We're frost free a little bit earlier in the spring than it used to be, and the first frost comes maybe a little bit later in the fall than it used to come. And you don't have to go very far in speaking with folks who have had their hands in the soil around here to know that stuff that they just could not grow 20, 30, 40 years ago takes off just fine now. And Brian, you mentioned a few of the things on your farm, but from more of a livestock kind of a point of view, how with a changing climate and changing weather and especially talking about the different bugs and other critters that make their way up and some of the regions for those expanding, I'm sure those all have to be considerations too.
Yeah, which I'm sure everyone has noticed our winters haven't been as hard as they used to be.
This last one was, I found to be quite enjoyable, if not necessarily hard.
Snow.
Actually having snow and it wasn't brutally cold and dry, which is the worst, but yeah.
But yeah, I typically lamb at least part of my herd in January, February, so they're ready for 4-H'ers. And
for folks who aren't familiar, to lamb a herd means?
Having babies.
Okay.
So they deliver in January, February, so they're old enough for the 4-H kids who do lamb projects mm-hmm. To bring to the fair. So it used to always be 20, 30 below, and I could expect that every lambing season to have at least most of it,
mm-hmm.
20, 30 below. And there have been the last few years where it's been 50 above, and which means I have to clean out the barn more often.
Those spring smells come along a little bit earlier.
Yeah, and you know, that's one you don't want your baby lambs mm-hmm. to be in,
a lot of that mess.
That can breed a lot of bacteria. Yeah. So I mean, that's definitely something that's changing. Also, I found a tick on my dog.
You didn't. Did you really?
And that is something I think it was last summer, last fall. And that's something I've never...
That's a pretty serious issue because it's ticks are not something that we're used to up here.
No.
And it's, I know, you know, when I go back home, if you go out and tromp around through the woods a little bit, the first thing you do when you get home is peel off all your clothes and make sure you don't have any ticks on you because they can find some interesting places to hide.
Yeah. And being a born and raised Alaskan, that's not something I ever think about.
Mm-hmm.
And was just petting my dog and I was like, what is this thing?
Yeah.
And
so do you find yourselves sort of looking down south at where, whether it's dealing with ticks or other insects and looking for tips for how they've dealt with stuff down there that all of a sudden now we have to worry about here? Are they trying to find more resources sort of outside of our traditional temperate zone to figure out how to make things work? Is that something that's going on?
Or at least be prepared for the possibility that it might come up. And I know from animal husbandry, we still, you know, give out the minerals. We do a lot of natural plant medication type stuff for our animals to just in general help them with anemia or parasites, or so hopefully they'll be healthy enough that if something does come up here, they'll be ready.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I played it both ways, and I say that because Janice Chumley is the pest specialist on the peninsula, and she's phenomenal. I even had to go outside to get information, and they just came out with a new app for your smartphone for weed identification.
Interesting.
We've been asking for that for a while, and I'm really pleased that they did. I think it has a great potential down the road as more folks use it and get mm-hmm. more photos out there, because I'm always asked, what's this weed? And I don't know what it is, but I can send that picture to Janice and she'll say, this is what this is and this is what you need to do. The other side of it is we've had to use some plant labs in Oregon before because there was nothing up here that could help us identify certain things, but it's we both have local experts, and at times we may have to.
And sort of the degree to which there is that local expertise, of course, we're going to use that. But again, as things continue to change, sometimes that local expertise isn't here because we haven't dealt with some of these things before. Yeah.
Yeah, and getting back to what Brian had mentioned earlier about funding, you know, if our University of Fairbanks is supposed to be a research facility, mm-hmm. and if we had the funding that they used to have at Cooperative Extension there, we could maybe have some of these people researching and being prepared or looking at how to deal with pests specific to Alaska instead of another state.
Yeah. So many considerations on the local farm. Well, we're a little bit past the bottom of the hour, actually, and a good time to take a break and remind you, of course, you were tuned to KDLL, and it is day number one of our spring membership drive. And as we have been doing here now for the last year, trying to bring you as much local programming as we possibly can over the 2 days of our spring and fall membership drives. If that's something that you find some value in and that you would care to support, hey, give us a call, 283-8433. We've got folks standing by ready to take those calls. Feel free to stop by the station. I see Jersey Subs just stopped by and generously dropped off some lunch sandwiches for us. So you guys came just in time for lunch. And we're going to take, as we are at the bottom of the hour, just a real quick break here so I can refresh some water, maybe grab a bite of a sandwich, and we'll be right back with Amy Seitz and Brian Olson, Amy with Alaska Farm Bureau, and also Lancashire Farms, and Brian Olson with Alaska Berries. We're talking all about local foods this hour, but we are going to take just a quick break. Stay with us. Our favorite, Dave Brubeck, keeping you company. We're all caught up on our coffee and water and everything to get into the second part of the show here, of course, with Amy Seitz and Brian Olson talking all about local foods this hour during, again, day number one of the KDLL Spring Membership Drive. Once again, if you would like to call in, show us your support, 283-8433 is the number, or you can always go online to kdll.org and show us your support there as well. Always happy to help to have it. Every little bit helps so that we can continue to bring you all this great local programming and put as many local voices as we can on the air, because that's what we're here for. That's what we enjoy to do. And so wanted to continue this conversation. Amy, you mentioned a few additions to the farm just this morning, but for both of you, curious, you know, at this time of year, we're decidedly into spring, summer's right around the corner, waiting for things to green up. For both of you, kind of where are things at on the farm? How busy are we getting this time of year? So busy, I'm lucky to have you both in here for an hour, right?
Yep, I always tell people, you know, it'll be slower this winter, and it never is.
It never is.
It just changes what we're doing. I mean, right now, I'm lambing. We're now up to 9, and I think I have 6 or 7 more ewes to go, so that's going. We're getting fertilizer for the hay field, so as soon as the ground hardens up, mm-hmm. I'll be doing that. We're planting in the high tunnel, so we already have some lettuces. We have quite a few things planted. Zucchini's already in the ground.
Wow, yeah.
And then just draining.
We had a ton of snow this year, yeah.
Yeah, so, and looking at clearing more trees, cleaning up our raspberry bushes.
Yeah.
There's plenty to do.
Plenty to do. There's never a shortage of stuff to do on the farm, for sure. Yeah. And Brian, I'm curious, you know, having a little bit less of that sort of traditional farm kind of a setting where you're at, it's a little bit more specific and geared right towards berries. What is kind of, maybe walk us through the seasons in the year. I mean, we're at springtime right now and stuff obviously is in the ground and stays in the ground. You mentioned that you're kind of maxed out on having stuff planted. Is that right?
Well, we are. And everybody that I know up here that's farming or trying to do it to put a bean on the table, so to speak, it's their livelihood. That's how they sustain their family. They're hardworking folks. You know, they get up early and they work late and 7 days a week. And people who do that because that's, you know, I enjoy doing what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And I think most folks do that are into it. But it's this cycle of seasons up here. It's starting now to get more into a pattern. Like Amy said, we are putting a list together of to-do things every day of 20, 30 objects. I've learned that I'm never going to get caught up. It's not going to happen. So don't even go there. It's going from fire to fire. That's something Michael Bryan used to say. I just go from fire to fire. Because we've got so many little things going on all the time. We have to juggle all the time. And I think all farmers have to juggle priorities. There's some basic tenets that you have to do because of our short growing season. Even though the weather is changing, certain crops, strawberries, things like that, you want to get them in the ground as soon as you can. So it's looking ahead. What do you have to do to prepare? Right now, it's a frustrating time for me because you stick a shovel in the ground right now and you get about 4 inches down before you hit the ice, and it's muck up on top. So you can't go out in the field, but you want to because you've got work to do out there. So in the meantime, we're doing mixing up our composted soils, getting it ready for repotting up plants once we can. Mm-hmm. And the wine making is a daily thing, morning and night. We check where we're at with our wines. So we have to skip around a little bit. This time of the year, our ducks and geese and chickens are getting out to free range to get the first green grass that's coming up, and any horsetail or chickweed that dares stick its head up on the farm, they're going to get right on that. So that's always good. The bees, we're getting our bees Saturday, and we're getting them later this year, and I think that's kind of a good thing for us.
Yeah.
They increase our volume of our berries on our farm, probably 33%.
Is that right?
There's a lot of native pollinators, but we found by putting our own bees out there, we get bigger berries and we get pretty much 100% pollination.
And so you must pay a lot of attention. We hear a lot in the news about some of the threats to bee populations in various parts of the world. And maybe you could talk a little bit, are these the same concerns in Alaska that they have in other parts of the world in terms of pollinating bees and the overall health there?
You know, again, if you ask 10 beekeepers, you're going to get 11 answers. But my opinion is I haven't experienced colony collapse disorder up here, which they've labeled it as to mm-hmm. be. And the research that I've done on my own just to follow along with this thing, because we do keep bees, is they seem to have pinpointed several different things that cause that. One of them was neonicotinoids, and I butcher that word.
It sort of rhymes with nicotine, and it's the reason why smokers and chewers can't go into greenhouses when you're on some of these farm tours.
Well,
that's different.
That's different. Yeah. So
I'm getting my words confused.
Neonicotinoids is the pesticide. Okay. And tobacco mosaic.
There it is.
Virus
is the, but I think even with the neonicotinoids, obviously it's a pesticide, so anyone using it better know how to appropriately use it, but even research is showing that may not be the cause of colony collapse. I mean, the more you look at something,
the more possibilities there are. It could be any number of things.
And I guess now the bees down in the States are recovering, so it could have just been a cycle. You know, like a lot of things, it's
cyclical. Yes, yeah, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
But definitely, anytime anyone uses pesticides, please know it is a pesticide that
that has a specific function and is good at it.
Yeah, we haven't personally experienced any foul brood or any of these other problems in our bees that we keep at our farm. And the challenge, I think, for most beekeepers is wintering them over. That's a challenge up here. Sometimes you're successful, sometimes you're not. And, of course, the price of bees has went up dramatically every year for the past 10 years because of what's happened in the lower 48. And one good thing that's come out of that is I've seen a lot more new beekeepers getting into the field every year. And that's because of some other businesses that have started up. Sarah's Honey over in Kenai, she teaches numerous classes throughout the spring. She imports in bees. She sells the bees out. She makes great products, great beehive boxes. You don't have to pay for shipping. A lot more folks are getting into it. And I think that's what's going to help, because when folks where I get my bees from is Jim Vander.
I can't remember.
I butcher his last name too. I'm horrible with that. But he spent a lot of time researching this too. And I think the genetic changes, when more people can keep bees, that you get that genetic diversity. Where in the lower 48, it's been the number of beekeepers has dwindled, where there's more major beekeepers. So we've lost a lot of genetic diversity in the bees. So I'm seeing that throughout the United States as more people are starting to keep bees in different locations, so that maybe we can start building up some more genetic diversity to help. If you only got 5 or 6 people that are keeping 90% of the bees in the United States, when one of them go haywire, everybody gets impacted. So,
And the word diversity, you mentioned it, have mentioned it a couple of times, and it's, to me, it's almost a little bit counterintuitive to think of. We think about Alaska Farms as being these relatively small operations where you would think it would make sense to put everything you have into that one little space of this one thing, but the truth is that Alaska Farms tend to be very diverse and tend to have a lot of things going on. Brian, you mentioned having lots of poultry running around the farm to help take care of things, and of course we know, Amy, on your operation, there's all sorts of stuff going on, and all of it contributes to the overall well-being, and diversity is such an important part of a successful small farm. Maybe, again, to not so intuitive to think that way, but that's a key to it, it seems like.
Oh, yeah. I think not just for the health of the farm, you know, having a diverse, you know, we let the ducks run in and hopefully eat the slug eggs and the dome in the winter, and you know, the chickens clear ground for us. But I think it also gives an opportunity to not just, as you said, put all of our eggs in one basket. Because if,
right?
like this year, I had a mink, I believe, get in the chicken coop and wiped out almost 40 chickens in one night. Oof. So if all I had were chickens, that...
Yeah, that's a big, that's huge.
That's a big hit.
You're left with nothing to do. Yeah.
So I think just having that diversity for security purposes is good.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And you know, we're kind of running down to the last just about 5 or 6 minutes of the show here. We've been talking about all the things that you guys grow on your farms and all the products that are becoming more available as more folks get into it and as local food has become a much more of a mainstay. I think we should probably take some time to let folks know where all this stuff is available. And I know the Kenai Local Foods Connection, is this year number 3 coming up for that?
Is it 2 for the Food Connection?
Yeah.
Year number 2 for that.
Yeah.
So that's a main one, yeah.
And I know the Alaska Online Food Hub.
Mm-hmm.
That's in year 3. or, you know, starting year three. Obviously, there's the Saturday market in Soldotna at Soldotna L, in Kenai at the Visitor Center, and then Tuesday at the Food Bank.
It's hard to keep track of them all. Here's a great place to go. KenaiLocalFood.org is a really great resource that's popped up here, again, just in the last couple of years, that has become a clearinghouse for where everything's available, how to get connected with farmers and with farmers markets to get all these things. And are you both active at farmers markets and getting stuff out there, or do you have folks pretty much coming to you at this point?
In the past, we've been at the Saturday market in Soldotna. Last year, we didn't because our wool products were offered in a store front. But this year, it looks like we might be going back to the Saturday market. And then we use the online food. We're going to be using the online food hub. But we do a lot of, you know, off-farm.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, we started out at the farmer's market.
Right.
That's where we got started as far as our selling our plants and our berries. But now almost everything goes into product. So what we do is we're expanding the field. So we have a U-pick. We've done U-pick now for 2 years. Next year will be our third year for U-pick. And that depends on the weather, the climate, what our crop yields like, all those factors. But the folks that have been coming out from doing the U-pick have enjoyed it. We've enjoyed having them out. It's been a win-win for everybody. They get to pick their own fresh fruit when we have a surplus of a certain crop. So, you know, and again, all the local businesses that are using Alaska-grown products now, that's been huge. And Odie's was mentioned. For us, you know, we're self-distribute our own wine. We don't go through a distributor. And, you know, the local Country Liquor, you know, Benjamin from Country Liquor stepped right up and was one of our first wholesale customers. So we were really pleased with that. But it's expanded now. So there's a lot of other places that carry our products. But the farmers markets where we got started. We don't do farmers markets anymore. Because we have a retail store now at our winery, so that folks come out here. But
yeah, and what was it like to make that jump into having your own retail space? Did that feel like diving into the deep end a little bit?
It was really pretty smooth. It was a nice transition. I enjoyed the farmers market because I like visiting with folks that have a similar interest on growing things and where their food source came from and describing what we did. And we still get to do that out at the winery when they come in and they walk in and say, where did you get the fruit for this product? And we can just point out the window, you know, and say, it traveled 150 feet from there to the bottle that you're drinking it out of.
Yeah.
And so that's, for us, that's what worked well. But like I said, for folks who have excess fruit or vegetables, that farmer's market is a perfect place to go and sell your product.
Yeah. And as we've talked about a little bit during the show, one of the most important aspects of having a thriving local food scene and having folks having the demand there is to have that connection, because I know that I feel like, and you mentioned it a little bit earlier when we were talking about agritourism, there seems to be more and more of an interest in folks connecting with actually where their food comes from. You know, where does the steak come from? Well, the grocery store. Well, no, not exactly. And when you can put the face, not just of the animal, but of the person who raised the animal, that really helps folks to feel connected to where their food comes from and make them feel a little bit better about it.
Yeah, and I would say even not just the food. Obviously, it's fun to talk to people about where their eggs and lamb chops come from, but even our fiber, it's because we can say this skein of yarn came from Daisy, and this is a little bit about Daisy.
Uh-huh. And she had a great summer and did great for us. And yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, hopefully weather dependent, we're shearing on Sunday. And so that's always a big event. And people come over and help pick through the wool.
Yeah.
And then we bag them up into, you know, the individual animals. So we know whose fleece is instead of mixing all the white fleeces together.
Yeah.
And so we can definitely, and some of our sheep, we actually put a little picture of the sheep on the skein of yarn and have a little blurb about them.
And so it's way more about just knowing where your potatoes came from. You know where your shirts came from well, too.
That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I have a Gus hat and a Daisy hat. And
all the things that you never thought that you would get on the family farm, and here they are, live in the flesh. That's so great. Well, you know, we're just about out of time this hour, but I wanted to thank both of you so much for coming on and sharing a little bit about your operations and some of your thoughts about what's becoming a growing industry here on the Kenai Peninsula, and thanks for your efforts to help keeping that going. So again, Brian Olson and Amy Seitz, thanks so much for being with us today.
And thank you for inviting us.
Yeah, it's always enjoyable to be on here with you.
All right, and I'm sure we'll be doing it again soon sometime. So again, thanks so much for being with us today.